Good morning, everyone. On behalf of Communitech and Defined Health, I'd like to welcome you to our 23rd Annual Cancer Progress Conference. We have another very strong program this year, and I'm sure you're going to be very happy with both the information you receive and the interactions that you have over the next 2 days. Communitech instituted this conference back in 1985, and over the years it's grown in prominence and prevalence within the industry. It offers cutting-edge results on new opportunities in cancer research, and as many of you know who have attended before, it's definitely a worthwhile meeting. It's very gratifying to us that the meeting has grown the way it has, and we're very proud that everybody agrees that it's a meeting worth attending. Last year, Communitech and Defined Health reached an agreement in which Defined Health will take over the administering and running of this conference starting this year. And we feel that's a very good fit because Defined Health has a robust oncology consulting practice already, and they're very firmly committed to maintaining the quality and the growth of cancer progress. So as we at Communitech began our last year administering and helping with the organization of this meeting, we look forward to its continued growth under the auspices of Defined Health. We also want to thank our past clients, advisors, speakers, and consultants, and sponsors for all of the support they've given us over that period of time. And we expect that with Defined Health at the helm of this meeting, it will continue to grow and be a very important annual meeting within the industry. So now I'd like to introduce Jenny Lobel, Vice President of Defined Health, who can tell you a little bit more about today's meeting.
Thank you, Alan, and good morning, everyone. Before I begin, I'd like to give our special thanks to Communitech and personally to Sharon and to Alan Curry for bringing cancer progress into the world 23 years ago and for nurturing it over these past 23 years. Defined Health and Communitech are longstanding collaborators. We worked together about 25 years ago on the original Pharmaceutical Strategic Alliances Conference, and more recently for 10 years from 2001 to 2010 on Defined Health's Therapeutic Insight Conference. As Alan mentioned, we have a strong oncology practice providing scientifically, clinically, and commercially informed asset and platform technology evaluations and other strategic business development advisory services to many of you in the audience and others. And we're pleased to have an opportunity to continue to build upon the legacy of what we think is this very important conference. Next, I'd like to thank all of you for joining us and express appreciation as well for our sponsors. You'll see their names up on the screen. Thank you to Astellas Oncology, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Eisai, Genentech and Roche, GNS Healthcare, Janssen, Lilly, and Teva. And to our supporting organizations, BioCentury, Deloitte, Thomson Reuters, and the National Foundation for Cancer Research. Finally, thanks to our advisors, Sharon and Alan Curry, Steve Heller, Neil Rosen, Richard Gaynor, Mark Simon, Jeremy Goldberg, and Franklin Salisbury. A little slip of the tongue there. Not to forget Karen Giardina, who many of you met through the process of registering for the conference, and if you haven't, you'll meet her soon. She did a great job. This is her initial endeavor as far as running a meeting, and she did a fantastic job putting it together. A few housekeeping details. The agenda and speaker bios are in your handout. Since most of you know a lot of the speakers and their bios are very long and impressive, we encourage you to read them, and we'll encourage the moderators not to take up time on the panels doing that. I call your attention to the handy agenda that we printed on the back page of the handbook. After it was printed, we had a little scheduling snafu, so the morning schedule is a little off, and we inserted a page with the corrected agenda back there. It only does impact the morning, so after that, you can rely on the one that's bound in the handbook. Any slides that are presented will be posted on our website, and we'll send you a notification and a password when we put them up. Lunch today is at the ninth floor atrium from 12:45 to 2. There's a reception tonight and an optional Svent Georgi Award dinner, and they're hosted by the National Foundation for Cancer Research. They'll be on the Broadway foyer and Broadway ballroom. I believe that's on the fourth floor, but I could be wrong. If you'd like to join the dinner and you haven't yet signed up, the NFCR people are outside with their credit card machine, and you can join the dinner. A reminder today, in case you're not staying with us till tomorrow, the checkout time is 12 noon. Couple more. Quick note on the meeting format. We encourage questions and active participation and discussion from the audience. We will leave it to the individual moderators to decide whether they want to have ongoing Q&A or whether they want to leave it till the end. We'll try to leave time at the end for this purpose. And we will have mic runners hopefully running around the room getting as many of your questions in as we can. So the agenda is packed with some really awesome panelists and speakers. We are going to do our best to keep the program on schedule, and I'm going to ask everybody here, audience and speakers and panelists, to work with us to try to keep everything on track so we don't get behind. We have a lot to accomplish. Thank you for your attention, and I'm going to turn the podium over to Jeff. He's going to give us a brief opening presentation before we bring up the first panel. Jeff Bachman is a VP at Defined Health, and he co-chairs our very busy oncology practice with Mike Rice, who will kick off tomorrow's session, so you'll meet both of them at the conference. Enjoy yourselves and have a productive conference. Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you, everyone. Since we don't have all the first panelists yet, I might be able to go long or talk really slow, which, as people who have seen me talk before know, is impossible. So, all right. Again, thank you all for coming this morning, and I just want to reiterate thanks to the panelists, to the sponsors, and, of course, to the attendees. So I'm going to give a very high-level overview of issues here. And of course, you know, in doing so with this type of audience, it's always a challenge. I mean, even though our work sits at kind of the trisection of kind of the scientific, clinical, and commercial issues, still creating a talk that kind of speaks to that diverse range of interests when you all are the experts in, you know, one or multiple of those areas is always very challenging. And in addition, it's always an interesting challenge to try and balance both the kind of the observational or the retrospective analysis, if you will, with kind of a more forward-looking or speculative or prospective view of the world. So I'm going to try and walk a fine line between all those issues. So one of the themes I'll reiterate in my talk is the idea we're in an age where, you know, oncology has always been data-driven, always about the data. We increasingly have new tools and technologies that are generating lots and lots of data and information that we want to analyze. And there are a couple of, I think, interesting ways to interpret that. One is that you are going to discover lots of things that we don't necessarily would have determined or thought of beforehand. So we are going to be surprised, and there are going to be, as I quote from Holmes here sometimes, there are going to be things that would have seemed improbable that turn out to be the truth. And I think to some degree one could argue that the increasing importance and role of epigenetics or the role of microRNAs, things that previously, you know, were contra to the dogma, could fall into that category. The other aspect that I'll talk about, again, is kind of trying to be open to the intuition and not just the pure data aspects, which is the original quote on there from Poincaré about, you know, intuition is important in the and creativity is important in the, uncovering truths. So first, some quick observations. And the first would be borrowing from both of the Heinahan-Weinberg papers that we've come a long, long way just in 10 years from the time of the initial famous kind of diagram of kind of the six key elements from the seminal 2000 Cell paper to kind of the updating of information and kind of the new understanding of the emerging role of some of the things that weren't even in this original point, such as the I think my pointer just went out. Such as the role of the immune system and inflammation, et cetera. So, and you know, infrequently when I would give this type of talk to maybe a more scientifically inclined audience, I would then have a blowout of just the molecular circuitry of one particular pathway or one particular cancer. For you guys, I don't think we need that, but nonetheless, we are making progress at a dramatic rate. Now, since, as I said, we're kind of walking a line here between kind of scientific, clinical, and commercial issues, we're going to kind of sway back and forth. And so, you know, we can't get away at this meeting since it's our clients within industry who are, kind of paying the bills, if you will, from kind of at least a commercial snapshot. And this isn't going to be news to anyone, at least at the high level, which is that we are continuing to see the growth of oncology as a commercial enterprise being driven by the utility and the value and then ultimately the sales of quote-unquote targeted agents, whether those are the biologics like an Avastin or whether those are small molecule agents like the TKIs or MTKIs. And when looking at the kind of consensus analyst forecast, which is what this is based on from Evaluate Pharma and looking forward, you see that that continued growth is coming from those agents, also being driven by the fact that many of the historical foundational chemo agents have gone or are going off patent and are genericizing. But within those kind of quote-unquote targeted agents that are driving growth, there are a lot of interesting new players prospectively that might come into play, and I'll touch on those shortly. Now, also one of the interesting things that certainly you're all aware of and is going to be talked of repeatedly throughout the various sessions today, I think will be one of the underlying themes, will be the issue of patient stratification. And so just from this recent Nature article, just showing overall within industry, not just within oncology, how many approvals are coming from kind of orphan, or what they call the niche busters, and of those 11 that are within this orphan, 7 of those 11 are oncology, not surprisingly. And if you just do a quick count using just ADIS R&D Insight as a database, you can see how of the phase 3 U.S.-only products, 44% have orphan status. So that's going to be classic orphan status because many of the oncology indications are inherently orphan, but that's also going to be increasingly including orphan status by virtue of some type of molecular stratification or segmentation. And as you go down earlier into the pipeline, you can see that that number goes down. Of course, when you're early on, you may know much less about the status of that agent and how exactly you are going to use it. And I think also lurking behind those numbers in the early phase is there is still, at least our perception from the outside, still a belief within pharma, despite a lot of pronouncements publicly that everyone's going targeted and molecular stratification is the way to go, there's still belief, or maybe it's call it the hope, of finding those foundational types of agents that can be used broadly across multiple tumor types. And if you think back historically about what was driving that growth on the previous graph, it's clear that oncology saw that major transition from the blockbusters like Taxol or Taxotere, which were foundational and broadly used across multiple tumor types, multiple lines of therapy, multiple combinations, to, you know, on the one hand, agents like Avastin, a broadly utilized, quote-unquote, broadly utilized biologic, a new generation, versus, say, another track within there being the more targeted, narrowly selected agents that are targeted driving growth, whether that's a Herceptin or a Gleevec. And then, of course, you know, within this context of these targeted agents, however loosely we might define those, whether those are as targeted as a Herceptin or simply targeted to a specific moiety like a VEGF, that a lot of the activity in deal-making is going to be driven by the interests of biopharma within those targeted agents. And, of course, industry is still very interested in a lot of early deals within oncology, and a lot of the expectation and hope, and some degree that, yes, that does become hype. In fact, there was a recent article, can't remember who it was from yesterday, kind of equating all the interest in stem cells recently and targets in that space to kind of the tulip craze. Now, I'm not sure it's quite that far yet, but certainly there are fads and fashions within industry. It's not just within oncology. But that being said, the amount of deal activity broadly within overall bio-industry space has slowed down, but oncology is still one of the leading players, not as dominant as it used to be, with CNS giving a good run for its money these days. But that being said, there are still not only interesting, very large, at least for the and valuable upfront for the biotech deals that are being done on novel, unvalidated targets, such as the Bayer Oncomed around the Wnt, but there are also still lots of interesting and large, at least in BioWorld dollars, deals around platforms and technologies. And if you just look over the past 2 years for the top 10 deals by BioWorld size, were these interesting platform deals, both next generation monoclonals, the DART biospecifics or macrogenics, the Kyowa deal with the Cerna RNAi, the stapled peptide deal of Roche and Aileron, and of course this is the Amgen Micromet deal pre-acquisition. So biologics are still being a major component, as well as a lot of still early discovery and really kind of pre-proof of concept deals with oncology, which is what we classically have seen. And as I said, a lot of these are still biologicals. Interestingly, the what's defining the biologics now is diversifying, which is, I think, good and interesting, so that now 11 of these deals, of these top 20 deals within biologics are not just antibodies, as they might have been, but now also include, you know, fusion proteins, RNAi, I thought I had fixed that, recombinant virus or oncolytic viruses, as well as the various types of immunotherapies, cell-based or otherwise. Now, one of the things that many clients certainly want to know is about the rates of transition. And again, you know, the slides that we're leveraging here, a lot of the data from Deloitte Recap, show that if you're going to kind of play the numbers game rather than, you know, working from where the science and the target's going to lead you, you at least might be inclined to want to play in the heme space for a variety of reasons. And I'm not going to go into too much space because I don't want to steal Mike's thunder before his talk tomorrow. But needless to say, there are a number of reasons that might underpin that. And I'll just simply state the kind of more obvious one, of course, that the heterogeneity of solid tumors versus that of liquids. Now, I'm going to put that in quotes because we're certainly learning that many of these previously presumed to be homogeneous types of even heme malignancy are, in fact, quite diverse as one starts to sequence them and look further. So I'm just going to touch on this one briefly because it's really unclear what this really means, other than it's better to have a partnered product than a not partnered product for a biotech. The question is, what does that reflect? Does that reflect kind of biopharma's skill at determining what is going to win? Does it reflect biopharma's skill at making something that they've partnered win by bringing it across the finish line because they have all the resources, or is it, you know, one of the key factors, which is that for many of those biotechs these days, they just don't have the wherewithal to push those products across the finish line, or they don't have the wherewithal to develop the product in the most appropriate way and make decisions and shortcuts and do uncontrolled phase twos, et cetera, and at the end of the day, you know, either don't get the signal they want or aren't able to partner it because the pharma says, well, come back and show me the, you know, the controlled data. I think, you know, for, you know, kind of setting off the tone of this year and this meeting, the deal that Genentech and Constellation did, I think, is particularly interesting, not only because it is a reflection, as been publicly announced, both when we talked with Kevin Sin as well as in the BioCentury article about this, about kind of the maturity now of the epigenetic space, but also because that epigenetic space is not the kind of the single narrow world that, of course, everyone always thought it was, just like they often do in many other mechanisms of action, but in fact, quite a diverse array of very complex interactions and complex complexes with lots of different targets. And so in many ways, this deal struck us, myself, Ed, and Mike, as being, you know, very much like in kind of Roche's investment in Genentech, that it's really displaying, it's giving a certain amount of autonomy, but buying into a lot of inherent intellectual capital as well as the knowledge around the targets and the tools, et cetera. So it'll be very interesting, and hopefully that pans out as well for both parties as the Roche Genentech had done. My next few slides, I'm just going to go briefly through what from Thomson Reuters, Cortellis, kind of prepared for us, kind of what they considered the top 20 agents by sales. So from kind of consensus analyst forecast, projected to be launched, over the, the ensuing 5 years or so. And when you kind of look at the mix of these top 20 agents, you, of course, see a lot of kind of next generation or follow-ons of kind of validated spaces. But they also see a lot of interesting twists on those, and increasingly a number of very novel types of approaches. So, of course, you have the dimerization inhibitor from Genentech, very interesting, very good data, and that just then raises the issue of what that space is going to look like for other people trying to play in that space. And I just call out one, for example, the early MacroGenics program that is engineering around the affinity of the Fc binding region, and presumably might be able to target a non-HER3 or lower expressor metastatic breast cancer or other cancers. So, and there are many other approaches. Similarly, and we'll hear from Georgia a little bit later this morning, finally, after many years, VEGF trap. So we're going to have finally the first biologic follow-on within the kind of the angiogenesis VEGF space. But there also is lots and lots of activity still going on with MTKIs. And even earlier, some interesting plays like the PTC compound, which is using their GEMS platform for targeting and altering ribosome interactions at the UTR, seems to affect only pathologic VEGF. Now, how that really pans out in terms of clinical trials, remains to be seen, but at least theoretically an interesting type of approach. Then, of course, now, as I said, we also have some novel agents within this top 20 programs. We have oncolytic virus from Eurylicin, which is inherently kind of stratified because of working in RAS-activating mutation cancers. Other oncolytic viruses have been engineered to work in other types of settings or have had their targeting redirected to particular cell types in one way or another. As I said, there are multiple MTKIs that are at play. A variety of now, finally, immunotherapies are showing up in this top 20 space. So now that we have Provenge and Yervoy, we also have a variety. And because it's such a catch-all in immunotherapy, it's not clear that, that this field has really been de-risked in any way, because there's a big difference from an autologous dendritic like Provenge versus the CTLA-4 targeting of Ipi versus a recombinant MAGE or the peptide or Vicals kind of co-stimulatory plasmid-based delivery for B7 and beta-2. And then, of course, there are kind of the more traditional kind of biosuperior, biofollow-ons, biobetters, a variety of names, but things that would appear to be besting either the EGFR targeting or anti-CD20, both from ImClone and from Roche, the originators. But there are also earlier agents playing in this space, such as, say, the Symphogen kind of double antibody, double monoclonal, double epitope targeting that may have some efficacy in non-responders or partial responders. But again, all of this is happening in the backdrop, certainly ex-US and potentially going forward in the US, of biosimilars to many of those molecules. And that's going to be certainly one of the themes that we'll hear throughout the day and certainly tomorrow in the panels, is the pressure that payers will be putting on these various products, whether it's coming from generics, biosimilars, or just some inherent type of pricing pressure. And that leads me to some speculation. So aside from issues within kind of the broad biopharma space where payer work is becoming so important, in oncology, this was an area where 5 years ago did very little work around payer, right? It was basically, is it an interesting, novel, sexy target? What's the clinical data look like? But more and more, the evaluations, whether for the in-licensors that we're working for or for the originators, are needing to look at the payer research. What is this product going to need to do, not just clinically or for approval, but for traction with the payers? Now, oncology previously had been relatively sacrosanct in terms of pricing pressures, in terms of kind of the payer issues. But now, as you can see, some of these trends in terms of prior authorization and certainly some of the trials that are being floated with clinical pathways, and we'll talk more about that on the POR and comparative effectiveness trial tomorrow, and I'm sure it's going to come up in multiple other places today, as I said. So this means that just showing proof of concept, while for very early oncology programs, it's still going to be able to lead to very big deals being made in the space. As those progress and start to generate deals, start to generate data, it's no longer going to be sufficient to say, well, we have a phase two agent, it's a novel target, but the data that's being generated is not so strong, it's just a different pathway or mechanism. Now, yes, you could make a rationale for why that having additional mechanisms would be useful in oncology, but nonetheless, being able to show that that's clinically going to have a sufficient signal at the end of the day is important, not just for the patients, but also for the payers. And of course, one of the ways of countering the pressure on pricing and not having another Me Too and trying to differentiate is, of course, to have the molecular stratification, whether that's inherently built into the target and the molecule or whether that's arising through some type of molecular analysis or of the patient and or the tumor. But clearly, it's going to take a lot of Xalkoris, crizotinibs, to build up, if you start slicing and dicing the pie of lung cancer, to equal kind of the overall market size of oncology. So this is kind of this classic strategic marketing nightmare within oncology that I remember, you know, 7-8 years ago, kind of on the early panels we used to have, talking about the future of personalized medicine and oncology, this fear of kind of this stratification in these niche markets, and how are you going to build up a sufficient blockbuster franchise, not necessarily a blockbuster inherently. And so, you know, to take, you know, kind of projections for a Xalkori or a Zelboraf and what it would take to build up to, say, to the classic blockbusters, modern blockbusters like an Avastin, it takes quite a bit. And, of course, as I said, data is a lot of what's driving the advances now, and certainly on Colin's panel we'll hear a lot about this and the ability to sequence. This is the ion torrent, and this is from Nanopore technology, mini ion. And so being able to sequence someone's tumor DNA in a day or two is certainly going to dramatically change not only the information we have, but the ability to make decisions, assuming that we have drugs for all the genetic and epigenetic and other changes that we find in those patients' cancers. But that being said, there are still basic bottlenecks that we need to get past. We need to understand better about how to target metastases, whether that's issues in terms of stem cells or otherwise, better models, better drugs, so that ultimately we can move from treating these advanced stage sick patients who, by and large, we are still not curing, to a situation maybe where we can move into some type of treatment and prevention, whether that's a secondary prevention in some type of maintenance setting where you're preventing recurrence or ultimately where you're able to move it forward or not. There are clearly lots of challenges logistically and regulatory and otherwise, and this will be touched on one of the panels that we'll be having. But that certainly is the goal that we have to go to. But again, the cancer is a very complex, dynamic space. It's constantly evolving, and so we don't want to get a hold of ourselves thinking that we are going to readily be able to do this just with information. We need to be able to step back sometimes from that information and draw some inferences and have some intuition lead us to that. And I'll just end quoting the famous Argentinian writer Jorge Luis Borges that, you know, you don't want to get stuck in a situation where you're too focused on just the data, the linear view, where this particular character, where it bothered him that the dog at 314 seen from the side should have the same name as the dog at 315 seen from the front. So in other words, you know, being able to abstract, to generalize from those data and draw interesting conclusions is going to be just as important as the actual factual details of the data itself. So I thank you for your time, and now we look forward to our first panel of the day on the broadly labeled future of cancer with Stephen Averbusch and Larry Norton and Gert Goldenbag, and moderated by Neil Rosen. And there's Neil. So thank you all.
We can start with some comments from my distinguished panel members here. I guess I'm only here to be inflammatory, so I'll start off by commenting on Jeff's talk and starting from there. I want to make like 3 points. When a drug becomes genericized, it doesn't stop working. Okay, so I think we don't want to stop using them just because your market share decreases. Secondly, we are going to definitely not continue to look for drugs that treat all cancers. What we've had so far is drugs that treat all cancers by not working. Okay. Avastin, show yourself the Kaplan-Meier curve if you have a relative who has the Avastin disease, and you'll see what a great drug it is. See how ecstatic you are to give it to a friend rather than sell it to somebody. I think it's a great thing that the payers are looking for actual effectiveness. And the way you're going to get actual effectiveness is by treating one of the 800 diseases that cancer is with a drug specific to that disease. That's what's going to happen. So with that, there are a lot of obvious questions that have come up from Jeff's talk, how we're going to work with smaller disease populations in which we have effective drugs. I should say for the thing I said last, what we're going to go from, I don't think there's anything else that's important besides data. What we're going to go from is a criterion of a p-value, which most physicians don't understand. So a p-value with a 4-day increase in median survival or survival advantage, that's what's gotten you approval, or at least a 12-day for Tarceva with gemcitabine. That's not going to work anymore. It's going to be data that shows a significant increase in survival or increase in patient well-being for a significant time, and that's what we should be going for. So with all that, there are a lot of new drugs. I think probably the most important thing that's happened in the last 2 or 3 years is an immunotherapy that actually works. And the immunotherapies that actually work are the immune checkpoint inhibitors, CTLA-4 and PD-1. Ipilimumab, what's PD-1? Does PD-1 have a name yet?
No, not yet.
Okay, PD-1 inhibition or ipilimumab. It actually works. I can tell it actually works because tumors actually go away. That combined with targeted therapies and the ability to genotype, as Jeff said, are going to transform the field. So any comments from you guys before we start asking?
You said there were 3 points. I only heard 2.
Department of Commerce. So I don't know if we want to start with some questions from the audience or some Dr. Norton. Would
yeah,
you like
I'd love to
make
disagree with you in public. May I?
Oh, you can always disagree
okay.
with me.
Well, it's actually so easy to disagree with you because you're so wrong, Neil. Anyway, we're very good friends and we're collaborators and we're colleagues and we share grants, you know, and Steve's an old friend, so I mean, this is just joking around. It's a fantastic, you know, talk, and I think that the introduction was really, really superb. You know, like everything else, I mean, you know, there's, you know, things are not right or wrong, they're partially right, they're partially wrong in this situation. I'm not a big fan of targeted therapy. And I think Neil illustrated that. He gives, you know, he says that, you know, we have to subcompartmentalize and we have to sort of target and we have a new immunotherapy that works. What we really have to do is we have to go for big effects and not small effects. And then he talks about IPI, anti-CTLA-4. That's a very small effect. And I think that we have this kind of schizophrenia in the academic community about that. I mean, to get grants to get promoted for those who still need promotion, younger people and whatever too. I mean, this is a reasonable pathway. If we're really going to break the cancer problem, I don't think the incrementalism of targeted therapy is all by itself the way it's going to happen. Now, I'm not saying that targeted therapy is not the answer. I'm just saying it's a partial answer. And what we're finding the enormous complexity is such that even in one tumor, no one tumor has all of its cells with one target. I don't know any targeted therapy that's cured anything. I know great responses. I know durable responses, but you get mutations of targets, et cetera, and everybody in this room knows what I'm talking about. So we have to take into fact that we're talking about something that is true but not completely true. And the answer is, you know, you sequence everybody, you find the driver mutation, you hit the driver mutation, the cancer goes away. It hasn't happened, and I don't really think it's going to happen. I think we're dealing with enormous complexity. And I think those last few slides that you showed, Jeff, are really, really clearly show enormous deal of complexity. And I just want to put out two ideas in this regard. I'm sure other things will come up in discussion. One is that we've had complexity before in biology, and we've never solved complexity. Let's take astronomy. You know, where are the planets? You know, where are the stars? Why do they move the way they do? Let's take nuclear physics. Let's take electronics. I mean, you know, if we were as far advanced as in cancer as we are with the iPhone in my pocket, you know, we'd be in an entirely different world. We've dealt with complexity before. We've never dealt with complexity without having engineering, and engineering means math. And computational biology is really very advanced as number crunching, but really a mathematical insight into the process of cancer is something we essentially are totally lacking. Many people are trying to. I'm trying to. My colleagues, John Lewis, is sitting here, and we're trying to develop mathematical models for dose and schedule, for example. But that this used to be the trunk of the tree of science, and now it isn't even a branch anymore in biology, really, in cancer. And you know the apple that falls, but until you have an equation that describes how fast it falls, and how long it takes to hit the ground, you can't build airplanes and you can't build rockets, and that's not going to come from intuition, that's not going to come from, yes, everybody knows that apples fall, it's going to come from engineering. And we don't have that. And I think that's one step that's very important. I think it's going to lead us into combinations, novel combinations, combinations of things in the proper dose schedule sequence, stuff that actually Neil and I are working on. And you can't do one without the other. You need the biology, but you need the engineering as well. So that's point one that I want to make. The second is that a very good friend of mine, when he saw that people started getting very excited about sneakers, you know, running shoes, and all his friends went out and tried to get stock in companies that make running shoes, or whatever. Too, he found out who made shoelaces. Found out that actually most of the shoelaces in the world made by very few manufacturers, and bought as much equity position in shoelace manufacturers as possible, so that whatever shoes were hot, they needed his shoelaces. And I think that if, from a business point of view, it is very, very likely that the best targeted therapies in the world, and I think they're going to be combinations, and there's going to be doses and schedules that are going to be specific and tied to imaging, which is another important topic, but that they're going to need companions to really make them work better. All these wonderful biologicals we've heard about really work better when you combine them with old-fashioned cytotoxics, for example. I mean, I worked on Herceptin for many years, and the fact of the matter is, all by itself, it's a really crummy drug until you combine it with drugs like paclitaxel, for example. And this is across the board of Avastin, which actually has, you know, tremendous efficacy in certain diseases, you know, breast cancer not being one of them, but certain diseases, clearly in combination with old-fashioned cytotoxics. And so I think that we got to start thinking more about as much about the shoelaces as about the running shoe. And what are the companions? Because if you really have the good, you have that, the better cytotoxics and companion molecules, HSP90 inhibitors that Neil and I have worked on in the past, for example, and I'm still working on, we're still working on both of us, that in coupled with these targeted therapies, then no matter what new hot targeted therapy comes in or what niche comes in, the companion is going to be something that's going to be a consistent backbone. And so I really do think there's a future, but not from kind of taking polarized positions, but rather from taking the best of many points of view.
Steve, if you want to...
Can I?
Bert? Yeah. Go ahead.
I won't have anything to say. And just to add another dimension, to that, as we know, drug development, which is part of all the tools that you want to combine in your combination strategies, is not becoming easier. It's actually becoming harder. And the hurdles are not going to go away. The hurdles are going up. New hurdles are being added. So, the endpoints that the agencies ask for are not being easier to meet. And in addition, we now have hurdles to make to meet the satisfaction of our payers. And I think that's part of the, if you look at the future, where's the healthcare going? I think currently healthcare costs are unsustainable. We heard it from the politicians, but I think it's true, because we see that if we do drug development, that we are looking at outcomes more and more and more. And I think that's something we shouldn't forget to probably direct our therapies as well, because if we can provide the better outcomes, I think we will provide better therapies.
So I think everybody's right. I was hearing a lot of similar themes, although we may have been packaged in different ways. I think what we're all saying is that whether it's sustainable on a societal basis or for an individual company basis, that the incremental marginal benefit is no longer going to be acceptable in terms of human cost and economic cost. So we're all striving for the definitive, clinically meaningful differences in novel therapeutics, and it isn't going to come through a one-drug, one-target approach. And I couldn't agree with Larry Moore. I mean, you have to look at the HIV model and look at the combinatorial approaches to that disease and to hepatitis C and others that we're finally getting sophisticated enough to understand sufficient biology to combine different agents targeted at different components of the biology, not only in the tumor cell, but at the immune cell as well. Neo made reference to some of the immune therapies that have emerged, including Yervoy. And we have a whole pipeline that's not directed at only producing the next Yervoy or the next generation of immune therapies, but looking at how we can best combine immunotherapies to enhance T-cell effector function, to enhance ADCC, to enhance NK cell function, and to use them together along with conventional generic drugs, along with targeted drugs to maximize therapeutic benefits. So it's going to be a more challenging model, but I think that we're all setting the bar very high for ourselves, and we're not interested in developing drugs that are going to be marginal or just going to have a p-value, and because it's not only is it not acceptable to the regulatory agencies, it's not acceptable to us as a deliverer of medicines for improving patients' health.
Absolutely. It's interesting to hear this and open it to the questions. The new revelation is we have to look at outcomes. We've always looked at outcomes, but, you know, it's unacceptable to have marginal, very marginal outcomes and charge billions. You're not going to make billions of dollars a year by giving a drug to all cancers. It gives you a tiny increase. And, you know, the hysteria over we probably too complicated to talk about now, but of the Avastin breast issue. I'm not sure why there's not also an Avastin lung issue. So why don't we open up to the audience?
I want to make one other comment that we didn't touch upon, and I think that's, information. And I'm not talking about sophisticated informatics of genomic sequencing information, but information that's usable to the end user. I've been more and more involved in personalized medicine activities at BMS, and I'm beginning to really appreciate that it's the generation from diagnostic approaches and companion diagnostics. How is that information getting synthesized, interpreted by the physician, and what tools are we providing for the physician to appropriately use the information and apply it in the optimal way? And I think it's not just making the medicines, but it's also constructing the data and the information that's packaged with the medicines that are going to be emerging in the next decade.
Neil, can I jump in on that?
I think we should have some questions.
Whatever the first question is, I'll say what I was going to say before Neil didn't let me say.
Well, then we won't have any questions. It's fine with me. Go on. Well.
One thing that's impressed us at Genentech, Neil, has been how quickly resistance comes with some of these highly targeted therapies. We've seen this with Zelbrav within 6.7 months of starting therapy. We understand a fair amount of what it is, and we're now doing combinations with a MEK inhibitor, but you're seeing the same thing with crizotinib. I'd be curious as to whether you think part of the future of cancer therapy is going to be a combination of highly targeted therapies, but then battling the inevitable resistance that seems to be coming up almost quicker with those agents than with some of the past agents.
Okay, let me refer back to something Larry said so he can't say it. I think, and I'll give a little dig about the immunotherapy. The point about the immunotherapy is, and it goes right to Vemurafenib now?
Zelbrav,
the RAF inhibitor, Plexicon. Sorry, that's a Genentech drug. The point is the same as the point with Yervoy. We never had an immune therapy that worked before. We don't know the dose. yet. We don't know the schedule, which is, if you want to talk to me and Larry, you know, you'll get nauseated hearing about schedule in about 5 minutes. But we don't know the schedule. We don't know the dose. We have no biomarker. 15 to 20% of patients respond, and a good proportion, which is minuscule, as I agree with Larry, but they may be cured.
Yes.
Okay? That's a breakthrough. What's a breakthrough about this to me is not now to put this on billboards, give this drug to everybody. What's the breakthrough is that something works, and now let's figure it out. And I would say, well, I completely agree with you, and obviously the other thing Larry and I both do is spend the rest of our time talking about schedule in combinations. I totally agree. But the fact is we don't know what the hell's going on with RAF inhibitors, really. Yeah. Some patients are alive and relapsed and unrelapsed 2 years later. I do think there are schedule issues. I do think there are issues in how to give it. And, of course, you know, we work on the combinations, too. But I think that's also the advantage of, as you know and many people in the audience know, the idea about giving a targeted therapy, releasing antigen, and then giving the appropriate immunotherapy, that's an idea. These are all ideas in evolution. It took, I don't know how many years to get an immune therapy that worked. Think about vemurafenib, a targeted therapy. The gene was discovered, the mutation was discovered in 2003. The drug was made for prime time by 2006 or 7. The stunning phase 1 data was there in 2009, and now we're talking about how inadequate it is. The breakthrough is tumors that melt with Zelboraf, crizotinib, EGFR inhibitors. Now what do we do next?
So I wanted to highlight the same point you made about average response in targeted therapies versus immune therapies, where you might have a very small effect in most for targeted therapies, whereas the average effect may be similar in immune therapy, but what you have is a small proportion who are ultimately cured. And I think the agencies have to understand the difference between those two, and that there may be some value in approving immunotherapy that has dramatic effects in a small number.
Steve and I worked as clinicians side by side many years ago, and and from a clinician's point of view, it's always true that you have heterogeneity response in your patient population. There's no drug that works uniformly in everybody. There's always differences. The first patient I put on Herceptin in phase 2 trial is still in complete remission. Chest wall disease disappeared, stopped Herceptin a bunch of years ago, frankly. She just got tired of getting it, and still, you know, she's as cured as anybody could be. So you always have very, very divergent kind of responses in this regard. I just want to make a couple of points that on this regard. There is no drug for any disease that is a good drug unless you know the right dose and schedule. All right. If you have a headache and I take a bunch of aspirin tablets and I grind it down and I put it in a jar and I say this powder will cure your headache, the odds are extremely high you're going to either take an insufficient dose and your headache won't go away, or you'll take a lethal dose. Not knowing the dose, not knowing the schedule, you know, you're just gonna be in really serious trouble. And we have not focused on that. And there is this myth in the targeted therapy community that's starting to break down, which is that if you have a target, what you gotta do is you gotta suppress it continuously as hard as you possibly can, get rid of it. That's your guaranteed way of getting resistance. In anything that I know of is continuous exposure at a dose that's not curative, but is maximally suppressive. It's the guaranteed way, mathematically, it's the guaranteed way to get resistance as rapidly as possible. So intermittent exposure may not totally inhibit the development of resistance, especially if it's by mutation, but it can dramatically reduce the short time course. It can dramatically increase the time the drug can work and may actually be curative. I mean, you need an example of this in your own life. You're in a swimming pool and you're trying to get across the swimming pool. So you walk across the swimming pool. It's deep enough that you can walk. And if you try to go as rapidly as you can, you're not going to go anywhere. The water resistance is going to hold you back. If you take a step and stop, take another step and stop, it's easy to cross the pool. So that, you know, going at maximum speed, as aggressively as you can, is a guaranteed way you're not going to get across the pool. And actually, that exact same mathematics applies to dose and schedule of drugs, exactly the same in terms of the emergence of resistance. So that's really one point. On the anti-CTLA-4, and there's kind of two points. So we're doing this when the early data was coming out, Jim Allison, my institution, obviously very involved in the discovery of anti-CTLA-4 as a modality. lamenting at a talk that, you know, part of the problem is that the cancer is not secreting enough antigen, not putting out enough antigen. So we came up with this idea of actually using cryoablation to freeze a tumor and therefore destroy it by freezing it. And then when it thaws, it releases intact molecules. They've been frozen, flash frozen. It's the best way you can have an intact molecule. And so we did an experiment where we gave mice anti-C3 antibody and nothing happened. And we did cryoablation and tumors grew back. And we gave cryoablation anti-CTLA-4 antibody, and we got 90% cure rates. And the animals are immune to rechallenge with the same cells. And this is published, you know, information out there. So we're doing a clinical trial now in primary breast cancer where volunteer patients are going to have cryoablation and one single dose of anti-CTLA-4 antibody. And we're going to see, you know, what happens in terms of augmentation of immune response. It'd be a piece of cake to do this in melanoma because the lesions. Bristol isn't paying for this, by the way. I'm paying for this out of philanthropy because Bristol refused to pay for it. So the after successful, maybe they'll pay us back. We'll see. So the this is the point that I want to make is that it's not just the drug; it's how it's used. All right, and there's a little side point I want to make here because it goes together with a lot of things we've been saying. When dose level was really hot in oncology going back decades, and people thought the higher dose of the drug, you know, you get better results, which is not true. We did a study in Canada because we had good health records of looking at what dose is in breast cancer, what dose of chemotherapy patients received and outcome. And we did not find a good correlation between dose and outcome. We found the best predictor of outcome was the name of the treating physician. And some doctors just did better than other doctors, all right? And sometimes you use higher doses, low dose. They were just better doctors. So we couldn't publish this, obviously. And we just sort of sat back, sort of shaking our heads. But there is a lot of best practices out there in the practice community. And people have learned to use your drugs much better by empiricism and by sharing information with their colleagues. And I think there's as much or more wisdom in the practice community about the use of these agents than there is in the academic community. The academic community is a little more restricted in terms of how it can achieve what's called knowledge. And one of the really important things that's going to happen, I think, in the next decade is capturing best practices from actually patient care records, which now computer systems can do. And that could be, I think actually seeing what is it that the best doctors do to actually get the best results. It's not magic. They're making better decisions, but they're making better decisions on the basis of information, and that's capturable, and it's in the medical record, if it's a good electronic medical record, and it's something that is capturable. And I think that tied together with a lot of these other things we're talking about is really going to make a huge difference in the way we practice, but also the way we design drugs. We're going to find out that people are starting to use novel combinations and that they're working, and then we'll go back and we'll test them. And I think that's going to be another tremendous growth area in our knowledge base of how to improve cancer medicine.
Yeah, I agree. That's the focus on outcomes that we all need to share and learn from. I think one of the other things that I wanted to add is that we do often research on finding a pathway that drives a tumor. We sometimes forget to look at this in parallel, look at the research, what stops driving that pathway and the mechanism of resistance. We often look at it later when we find a resistance, but we should put it more upfront in our research.
Well, you can't have resistance without having sensitivity first.
I know.
Question?
So I wanted to pick up a point that Steve made about information. So it seems to me that the idea of companion diagnostics may not be the full technology of the future, that really what we're talking about is adequate classification of our tumors. And I'm wondering what the panel thinks about whether, and I contributed maybe to the Herceptin test, so I have a sense of where we went wrong. I'm not sure the companion diagnostics are providing the kind of information that we want in the sense that they're tied to particular therapeutics. And I'm curious whether this is a problem that we ought to move to address by a more wholesale, maybe academia-driven reclassification of disease, or whether we should stick to this current mode of doing things where if you think of a drug, you got to think of the diagnostic. And I'm just curious,
you can talk about this for hours. I'll just say briefly, very
briefly. You
can
talk about it as long as you want.
Very briefly. Number one, you sometimes need, the classification is key. it's multiple diseases, and there are diseases where your targeted therapy is going to, genotypes or biotypes where your targeted therapy is going to work and where it's not going to work. And that's key. That's number one. Number two, there's a sociology of the field. Larry mentioned imaging. You mentioned companion diagnostics. These are key things if used correctly. But what the field does is, in the absence of making any good drug or having any new information, you employ yourself by saying, we need biomarkers, we need companion diagnostics. The third thing, if we can expand that from companion diagnostics to biomarkers, and this goes to Larry's point about knowing what the hell you're doing when you give a drug, we almost never know if you fit the target adequately. There are very few assays. There are no quantitative assays. And again, going back to Zelboraf, something I know a little bit about, as you do, one of the Gideon Bolag's most important pieces of data, I think one of the most important pieces of data in the last 10 years in oncology, is if you inhibit the RAF pathway, ERK signaling, 80% in the phase one, you have zero responses. So you have lots of drugs that you guys make or invest in, and they fail. You have no idea if they failed because you have to hit four other things in combination, or because the target stinks to begin with, or because you just didn't inhibit it well. And those, they're not diagnostics, they're biomarkers, but those are absolutely key. It's a big part of what's missing. Larry can't know what schedule or dose to use. One of the big things about schedule and dose is which schedule can you use to get an effective drug in that's not toxic. And we just don't do those experiments in patients.
Yeah, so, again, you know, it's not just about the technology of a biomarker or a companion diagnostic. You know, we're I lead a center of excellence at BMS on developing companion diagnostics, and I rapidly realize that it isn't just about the technology, but, again, it's the more holistic approach to developing the information, the tools, and the medicines that combine will create a more personalized approach. And to what Neil just said, you know, ultimately, will we have the technology to do therapeutic monitoring on an individualized basis, to optimize dose and schedule, to monitor for the emergence of resistance mutations? You know, I think that's the crystal ball futuristic direction, that with appropriate tools, nanotechnology, other approaches, that will finally get there to for the practitioner to make those adjustments in real time.
So Larry mentioned dose and schedule, but he also mentioned sequence, which I think is equally important. And when you add those three together, it becomes very, very difficult to hone in on the best dose, schedule, and sequence. In particular, for the immunotherapies, where there may be a clear trade-off between exposing tumor antigens after cytotoxic therapy and the immunosuppression that follows from...
It's incredibly difficult if you never do the experiment.
He's totally right. I mean, the fact of the matter is that these problems, you can't solve these problems. If you know that apples fall and then you say, now build an airplane, you can't do this without having an understanding of, forgive me, the mathematics of the process. We don't have an engineering for biology yet. We're approaching it. And I'm involved around with a really interesting collaboration with the Courant Institute here at New York at NYU with really top-level theoretical mathematicians actually looking at matching. It's actually, it's your data, actually, Neil. I didn't even tell you about it yet. Targeted therapies, actually measuring the effects of targeted therapies on intermediate molecules that are critically important for driving critical cell processes like cell division, migration. Simple mathematical methods that actually describe this, and then tying that, perhaps they believe that you could actually tie that to genomic information using very sophisticated models. The research is just beginning, but it's something that I'm very encouraged by, because, you know, problems that seem totally insolvable can be solved if you have a tool for understanding it, a mathematical tool for understanding it. Without the theory of universal gravitation, you know, without Faraday's laws of electricity, which are simple equations, we don't have computers and so on. And I think that is something that is very doable and may not even be that hard, actually, once we actually start thinking about it. Very hard to get grant support for it, obviously, but I think in industries that can employ people, PhDs and whatever, it's something that really should be done much more.
Let me just quickly say, what's so hard? What's so hard about doing an experiment? Jed Walchuk has shown that Zelboraf actually activates T cells in conjunction with CTLA-4, and you sequence like that. Now there are an infinite number, you know, or just about an infinite number of sequences and hypotheses. You have to do this in a hypothesis-directed way, and it comes down to the lousy preclinical models we have. We've got to make better preclinical models that are predictive. But right now, this is the way targeted drugs are developed. You find a great target. If you're lucky enough, you have a great chemist, you make a drug against the target, and then you give it every day in patients. That's the way it's done at the maximally tolerated dose.
There's not scientifically hard at all, and I'm also in strong agreement that we need to spend the time doing this. It's a bias of mine. I think the challenge that we come up against, either internally with our companies or with collaborations externally, is people want to move fast, so they're not necessarily patient enough to do a study that's probably 10 times as long to really get the dose, schedule, and sequence right.
I agree with you. It is an enormous challenge, and we will not have the time and money to do all the experiments, even if the whole hypothesis is different. We don't have the luxury.
I would say that people are deciding.
You do have the luxury.
The time
you don't have the luxury to spend $300 million on something that fails.
Right.
There's an old Roman proverb: make haste slowly.
Yeah. I think that's.
It sounds better in Latin.
I think that's the potential.
I don't
want to have to translate it for
you. Everybody's right. If you're going to do this in people, it's impossible. You've got to do it in preclinical systems that are relevant to people, and then you've got to translate it so that, you know, I mean, I'll just sort of say, you know, so the ZioPharm collaboration I have with John here at Evers, and full disclosure, I got paid for this, is that we looked at animal data and dose and schedule, and we looked at the experiment of continuous therapy. And found that when resistance emerges, so you stop your drug before resistance emerges, and then you give it in pulses, and you have an entirely different approach. And this can be done in animal systems, and there's a published proof of this with capecitabine, with Roche's drug that is soon to go off patent, you know, where we have this published. Tiffany Traina is the first author, you could look it up, where the schedule that was widely used for, you know, since the very beginning was 14 days on and 7 days off, and a third of patients stopped drug for toxicity, not because of disease progression, which is awful no matter how you look at it. Bad for the patient, bad for the company, bad for everybody. And so simple mathematical modeling that we're much better at now, it was a first iteration, showed that the second seven days was causing nothing but toxicity, that all the impact was in the first seven. So we changed the schedule to seven on, seven off, and we phase two'd it, and now it's in phase three in Latin America, you know, in fact. And it's a entirely different drug. Patients come off much later, and they come off for disease progression, not because of toxicity. It's an entirely different drug, because seven on, seven off compared to 14 on, seven off. And now in the United States, the vast number of oncologists are using seven on, seven off in the base of that paper. So that you've got to pay attention to this. But the seven on, seven off didn't come from, you know, huge expensive clinical trials in patients. It came from animal data, and then a phase two, and then moving on. So that, yes, it is impossible to do in people, and that's why you got to do preclinical systems. Coupling that together with the kind of biological information that Neil has done and is doing, it could be an extremely powerful tool, and frankly, I think it's cheaper. Because if you go into your phase one, phase two, knowing the right dose and schedule rather than causing toxicity and having to go back to the drawing board, you're going to save money because it's the clinical trial that's expensive, not the animal work that goes on. And the math work is really, is almost for free comparatively. So that there's tremendous opportunities that are before us with targeted therapies and even, as I said, the shoelaces, the cytotoxic therapies that we're going to be combining them
first
with.
There. Question from the left, my favorite side.
I think you're all stating the obvious. It's mom and apple pie. And, you know, I used to tease schedules to death and with cytotoxics and with targeted therapies when I was in academia or being supported by a large pharmaceutical company. But the truth is, and I think I think you all realize this, but when you go on the other side to a small biotech company where I think a lot of the action is and the most innovative therapies, you don't have the funds to tease out dose and schedule. And I'm not saying that that's, you know.
No, that's absolutely right.
And
these,
you know,
experiments are the same as like contraception. Everybody wants to use them, but nobody wants to pay for it.
I thought I'd say that at some point today.
Neil, there might be somebody in the room you haven't offended yet.
Just tell me your religious group that you'd like offended. I think you're right. I think, let me tell you one more thing about that. You can't do this rationally without knowing what's going on in the tumor, which I try to do, or mathematics, which Larry tries to do. I'm too stupid to do the mathematics. To do that, you need biopsies. And that's where the contraception joke comes in. Nobody wants to pay for it, and the costs are way too high. And those are academic costs of academic radiologists and pathologists for whom academia means make more money.
But they need to be done, Neil.
They need to be done.
They need to be done, and I think it's largely a reflection of what needs to happen, and hopefully it will happen as pressures are put forward on large pharma that really cannot discover adequately, and the payers, and venture leaving the game for early partnerships between biotech and big pharma to actually enable biotech to broadly investigate their therapy.
So you have to examine why everybody wants to do it and it doesn't get done.
Just a point about the biopsies, and then I'll ask my question. So while, yes, they need to be done, oftentimes we're faced with the, and while more and more physicians will do them, oftentimes we're still faced with the fact that physicians don't want to, oncologists don't want to do the biopsy, so we have to solve that. But my question was, in Jeff's introductory comments, he talked about fragmenting the market and that this was a fear that we all have. And it used to be that some of us thought that if we develop a targeted therapy in, for example, lung cancer, that would translate into all other cancers that had that same alteration. And Neil, when I heard you talk a month ago about, you know, Zelboraf not working in RAF mutated colon cancers in the same way that it does in melanoma, does this mean that the fear of fragmenting the market really will come true, and that we will be faced only with developing these so-called niche busters?
No, I think, first of all, you know, I grew up in, like, the early 20th century, like in 1910, and I was hoping for an antibiotic that worked in all diseases. But, you know, we then developed personalized medicine, which I don't think is new. I think started in about 1200 BC.
Hippocrates.
Different antibiotics, different drugs. Now, with Zelboraf, again, it does work in colon. It just doesn't work very well. Now, the leading hypothesis I would have, and you can chime in, is that Zelboraf will work in colon when you add it to something, when you add it to what increases the feedback induction of RAS GTP in those tumors. That's a hypothesis which you would probably listen to, but it's a hypothesis to be tested, and then we can go on to the next hypothesis. The driver mutation will sometimes translate into multiple tumors. Sometimes it won't. There's a different biology of colon and lung. The fact is you make money. The field has gotten used to, A, not being able to cause toxicity because of oncologists and the FDA, and B, being able to make zillions of dollars from a p-value for a one-month increase in time to progression. We have to get rid of both of those things and make lots of money, make reasonable amounts of money from a toolbox of inhibitors. And I know I'm preaching to the converted when I talk to you about this, a toolbox of small molecules or immunotherapies or whatever the hell you like that allows us to treat in combination different tumors. That's where we're going to get. That is, as far as I can see, where we're going to get to. Anybody else want to?
Well, I just want to, you know, Laura, you were talking about fear of segmentation. And I don't see it as a fear. I see it as an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity to create high-value medicines. They're going to have value not only to the patient, but obviously to the company that's marketing these drugs. Now, we haven't figured out all the angles in terms of how do we de-risk our development of those drugs? How do we increase the time or decrease the time to market, decrease the cost to market? But hopefully by having the more targeted drugs, we're going to improve our success rate so that we're going to be putting less unsuccessful drugs into phase three. So I think, you know, we still have to figure out all the sides of the equation and all the levers that go into ultimately, you know, productivity and value. but I still see that as an opportunity for us to work with effective tools to get there. So I don't fear it. I look at it as an opportunity.
I agree with you, Absolutely. Steve. And I think the other aspect to add to that is that we can have small differences in clinical outcome, but who's going to pay for that in the future? You know, in Europe, whole governments fall over because they can't pay their society anymore, let alone healthcare. Here in the U.S., it will come. I mean, payers won't pay for small differences if the costs are going up. Why would they pay for that? I think that debate is still to come here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, this is a topic bigger than this room in terms of actually getting into this. I was it's a societal. First of all, you know, we got to just say the word again, imaging. You know, I mean, it's not, you know, what drug should I use to treat this patient, A or B? Well, why don't you try A, do a functional image 48 hours later, see if it's working. If it doesn't work, go to B. Problem solved. And I think that is, that's the way we use antibiotics for, you know, you have a urinary tract infection, you start an antibiotic, and, you know, if the culture is still positive a few days later, you switch antibiotics. I mean, the fact is that functional imaging, I think, is going to be, you know, what we're going to be talking about mostly 6 years from now in this room. But I'm at a think tank, an NCI think tank, probably about 10 years ago, and there was a guy in the back of the room, didn't say a word all during the day, and it was about this issue of fragmentation of the market and, you know, dividing cancer up into 1,000 niches and, you know, how are we going to do this? And we were debating about it the entire day, and it was, you know, academia and business, whatever, probably people in this room were at this meeting, and the guy didn't say anything, he's in the back. Turns out he was the after dinner speaker, and he's an historian. He was there, the NCI invited him, and he's an historian. And he says, and his anecdote says, like, I'm watching the ancient Roman armorers going to the ancient Roman Senate and, you know, and saying, we know the Visigoths have knocked down the gates of the city and are about a block away from here with torches, but how can you incentivize us to make swords? The fact of the matter is, you know, in this room, you know, is in this room largely male. No other comment on that, but largely male. Half of us are going to die of cancer. I mean, you know, the Visigoths are at our gate. And it's not just this. I mean, we're talking about society, you know. I mean, we're talking about the entire nation. So you're saying, who is going to pay for this, you know? The fact is that most of the money we spend on medical care is wasted. It's just really wasted money. Most of what we spend money on is really wasted money. You know, we could be cheaper and more effective and make it a societal, if it's a matter of social will to really make it the next step. And the Visigoths are at the gate of everybody in this room and everybody that we know. So it's not a matter of who's going to pay for it. It's a matter of not just throwing money away, wasting it. And I think that's really what we're really all talking about.
Yes. So Absolutely. Neil, just to go back to this issue about, combination therapy and resistance, and with Zelboraf, whether it works or not in a specific BRAF-driven tumor is simply a quantitative difference. So go back to Larry's mathematical analogy. And so I think what we're going to start to see is combination therapies being given right at the beginning, and one thing I'd be interested in is the idea of having two NMEs actually go through development at the same time, which I think is going to have to happen at some point. More commonly, I know that Art did push for that in an editorial a couple of years ago. It's one thing that I think is going to have to, we're going to have to see more of as we think about some of these science-driven ideas.
It has to happen now.
Yeah.
But again, it's just like we were talking about before. It depends on compelling hypotheses and compelling preclinical data. And, you know, we can all argue when we see an individual piece of data for a particular hypothesis what compelling means. But that's what it's going to depend on. You know, I used to give a talk on combination therapy, and number 11 was two drugs made by the same company or two drugs in a big market. It's got to be based on data.
I'm talking too much. This is the last thing I'm going to say. Do people know when I say new digs what that means? Anybody's heard the term new digs? Raise your hand. Okay. All right. So this is an MIT effort, all right? It's just beginning to be organized now. But the basic idea of this is to do some pre-competitive work on exactly what you're talking about. To have a clearinghouse, a scientific clearinghouse, and probably Boston-based, you know, with Broad and with you know, the tremendous capabilities there, and tie together with the community in terms of, you know, molecular analysis of patients to make them appropriate to be selected for trial. But that all of our companies would send in our exciting drugs, which would go into a thing, and it would be tested against cell lines and against tumor samples and other kinds of models. And if NewDigs finds that drug A synergizes with drug B in situation C, then these companies would be so notified. Guess what? Your product actually synergizes in this area with this other. Why don't you people talk about doing something collaboratively together? We don't have such a clearinghouse right now, and I think that this is something that is being talked about. But I would expect to have more activities of this nature, and it's kind of like a semi. Academic activity, though it's not going to lead to papers, it's going to lead to better cancer therapies, and so something that we're very, very much, interested in. If the community is going to be willing to basically pool some of its resources, at least in terms of its drugs and some of its money, to be able to do research at a pre-competitive level, so they'll know what are the right combinations. And so if your competitor sells some B, as long as it's with your A, you shouldn't care that much. And I think that that's something we're going to see much more.
Yeah, I heard about it. I heard about it in some other settings as well, and I think that's a really great idea that we would love to participate in.
Yeah, I'd like to see it combined with adaptive trial designs, too.
I think companies have, for the most part, not done, in my experience, is they have data that their great drug A against target A works really well against an inhibitor of target B. They have a crummy inhibitor of, is that a word? They have a bad inhibitor of target B. And what they try to get is trials with their good inhibitor of A and bad inhibitor of B. If they were smart, even economically, they would partner with a company that has a good inhibitor of B and go forward. Because most of these companies don't have approvals in anything. Getting an approval of one drug is a good thing. Just ask Novartis. Okay, and that's the market fragmentation thing too, just to stick in that point. And Novartis, they did not, Gleevec sat on the shelf for a long time because of the perceived small market of CML. The market for GIST was developed because of Gleevec. Oncologists' knowledge of the extent of GIST, which before that was for most part a poorly understood leiomyosarcoma without much molecular definition. Just the drug created, allowed us to discover the disease, and that is a bigger market than CML. Okay. So, again, there's no general rules. Sometimes you make a niche drug for Ewing sarcoma, and it will turn out to be a drug for Ewing sarcoma, period. Other times you'll make one, and it'll turn out to be important in a reasonable fraction of prostate cancer as well. This is the general way things are going to go forward, but there's no guarantee for any particular drug that schedules are going to matter, that it's going to work in a bigger market than the small market you found first. As a whole, though, that's the way things are going to develop. Other questions? Want to yell at me for anything, Larry?
No, I just want to fill the time.
I agree with you, yeah.
No, I just thought we should say something. I could yell at you, but I won't.
Yell at me, please.
I think it's a challenge. Yeah. Because if I have a drug that goes into phase one trying to figure out what dose we can use, and I have to go to, my board to get the investment and say, okay, where are you going to end up? That's the question I'm going to get. And I say, well, I'm going to end up in Ewing sarcoma. So, okay, well, your funds are significantly reduced right now. And they say, well, I may end up in another tumor type, because one of the large ones. So what are the chances for you to get there? You pick a number, and then my funds might go up or not go up.
Right, but that's a problem with large organization sociology, not with what's going on. That's why small companies do better.
But that's the problem we have.
The problem is...
So those drugs...
I heard that here about 10 years ago. The problem is that... Large companies have institutional bureaucratic inertia and will not take risks, but they have unbelievably great chemistry. Small companies do not have inertia. They're innovative, but guess what? The drugs that work are drugs. They're actually great drugs, and those are not made by molecular biologists, mathematicians, or commercial guys. They're made by chemists, which small companies do not have enough money to have the great chemistry that Pfizer, Merck, AZ, BMS, I want to leave everybody in here. That's the issue. Yes, I know, your board will say this and that. When I suggested that IGF inhibitors be used for metastatic relapse Ewing sarcoma, I got from two companies, we will stunt their growth in 3 years. Well, since they have a life expectancy of 5 months, who cares? But that's the kind of thing you get in a large bureaucracy. We all know it.
Could I just throw one other thing out here, and I don't have any kind of profound answers in this kind of thing, is that the reason we're talking about things like breast cancer and colon cancer is because if you go back a century or two, cancer was a surgical disease. And, and then radiotherapy came in, which is a more general approach, but still largely dominated by surgeons. And surgeons have to be anatomically specialized. The skills you need to do good colorectal surgery are different than the skills you need to do thoracic surgery. But we are rapidly moving past, the notion of the organ that the cancer coming from being the target. And we're talking about molecular targets here. We're all talking about it, and yet we're still talking about organ systems because we have this sort of this old surgical notion of cancer. And I think that's one of the things that we've got to get rid of. And so, this notion is, instead of saying it's a sarcoma drug, saying that, it's a drug for certain targets, certain situations, and sarcoma, 80% of sarcomas may particularly, have this, we're working on an oral alkylating agent, palsfosfamide, that has a right now and actually going through phase one trial, actually, that has a specific activity in cells that have an upregulated mechanism of resistance to other alkylating agents, for example, and the right dosing schedule overcomes some of these issues that we've worked on, and that it's and it's going to be applicable very broadly to tumors that have this mechanism of resistance, basically. And I think that one thing that we could do to sort of break out of this dilemma that we have is start to move away from talking about it's a sarcoma drug, it's a breast cancer drug, even it's a leukemia drug, but rather it's a it's a RAF drug or it's an EGFR drug. And then all of a sudden you could start to see, and that's exactly what happened with Gleevec, precisely, it's not a leukemia drug, chronic leukemia drug. It's a drug that works broadly depending upon the fusion protein and the upregulated target. So that we've got to sort of change our thinking and change our terminology, to take advantage of what we actually know.
Yeah, I agree with that. So let me ask you the question. Do you think that we are going to evolve towards a system where the organs are not going to be determining which doctor or which treatment you're going to get?
I think there's no question that that's going. I'm not that old, all right. When I went to medical school, half the department of medicine were specialists in infectious diseases, and they specialized in organ systems. One of my great professors was a specialist in pyelonephritis. That's what he knew everything there was to know about pyelonephritis. When to drain the abscess. Because the antibiotics often didn't work. There were very few antibiotics. They didn't work very particularly well. I'm rounding with an expert in pulmonary infections. He's an expert in pneumonia. He's an expert in infections of lung, and when to drain the empyema was a big topic. Now gargantuan hospitals like Memorial Sloan Kettering have I think 4 or 5 people that are ID specialists because we could all take care of infections. Why? Because we have a companion diagnostic. We got cultures, and we take we take the bacteria out, we grow them, we see the antibiotics work.
Lots of drugs.
And we have lots of drugs for particular targets, and the patients get better. We actually cure them. So you want to know what the future of oncology is? That's it. Mm-hmm. We've already done it with infectious diseases. We still obviously have a way to go. It's not totally eradicated. But, we've got vaccines. We've got prevention strategies. We know about hand washing. The equivalent for that in cancer may be avoiding obesity, for example. We know we have lots and lots of drugs. We targeted the drugs appropriately. We've got ways of monitoring them. Mm-hmm. We use imaging, extensively. We use retesting, so urine culture is like the equivalent of biopsy. We've done this already in biology. We just have to basically recapitulate that in oncology. So the future is essentially the past.
So apropos, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Apropos that, I'm curious about what you said about intermittent therapy. With infectious diseases, when you have a resistance problem, you address it by combinations continuously to prevent growth. You don't address it by intermittent combinations or intermittent therapy, which implies that the cell is still growing and that's when resistance emerges. And I'm wondering why we shouldn't expect that with single oncogene driven or single pathway driven tumors with bypass pathways that the hope for therapy wouldn't be simultaneously inhibiting both pathways.
It's not continuous therapy. It's just that the interval between doses is short with antibiotics. So you take your pill every 6 hours. You take your pill every 8 hours. You don't take your pill every 20 minutes.
And so on the half-life of the drug.
But it's also the growth rate of the bacteria, all right? And cancers in general grow more slowly. If we had cancers that grew as rapidly as Streptococcus, we wouldn't even be here. I mean, we'd all be dead. So the fact is that a lot of that has to do with the kinetics of growth of the underlying problem. Low-dose continuous exposure, when penicillin was first developed, they basically mixed it into paint and put it on the walls of the hospital. They thought they'd make hospitals sterile that way. And it was continuous exposure to penicillin, basically, that raised penicillin-resistant organisms in the hospitals. So they stopped doing that for that particular reason. So, I mean, if you have an infection, the worst thing you could do is take a minuscule low dose every 10 minutes of an antibiotic. You're guaranteed to develop resistant organisms. You take a relatively large dose, you take it every 6 or 8 hours, and that is the right interval for the growth kinetics of the bacteria. The same exact mathematics applies to cancer. We're just dealing with slower growth rates.
There's a fundamental difference between microbial disease and cancer, which can be summarized in one sentence. We don't have cell walls. Okay? The targets in bacterial disease are usually peculiar to the microorganism, so you can give a very high dose of the drug. When you give a continuous dose of a drug that inhibits RAS or MYC, let's say, two drugs we don't have, the therapeutic index may be such that you only get 50 or 60 or 30% inhibition of the target, and that may be inadequate. So it may be that a pulse of drug, 1, 2, or 3 days, will be tolerated with toxicity. It's just, the separation between cytotoxics and targeted therapy is just historical. It's got nothing to do with actual
right. So that's reality. That's a different point. And that's
But in fairness
with infectious diseases, the quintessential slow growing disease in which resistance emerges predictably is tuberculosis. And so I think it's clear that the paradigm of combination therapy, if tolerable for long periods of time with constant presence of the drug above the MIC in the case of a bug and above parameter would be for a tumor would be the best way to go if you could do it safely.
Anybody that knows me is going to know I'm going to push back just for the hell of it, no matter what you said, including 1 plus 1 equals 2. But I will push back and just say what I said before. I am not as smart as anybody in the room, so I have to do experiments. It may be, I totally agree that you may be correct. However, we have to do the experiment. It may be, against all odds, it may be that if we had patients who had brain and lung and liver metastases from germ cell cancer, it might be that an intermittent high dose of platinum would cure them.
It's true.
Okay, yes. Is that true? Is that thought already?
It's done.
Okay. So the experiment was done totally empirically by Larry Einhorn, and it works. I'm not saying you're wrong based on principles. I will also tell you, from advertise my own work, that when you inhibit an oncoprotein, you reactivate feedback inhibited pathways all over the cell. And by giving the drugs continuously, what you have, and this is what I think, I can't even count, I'm not a mathematician, when you give a drug continuously, you get rapid initial death and you get survival of cells with reactivated pathways all over the place. Having said this, I'm contradicting myself. I said, I do not believe in intermittent or continuous or anything else. I believe in your hypothesis or Larry's or anybody else's and then testing them. And oftentimes, at least in my case, I'm wrong. Okay? Test them, do them. You have a very good hypothesis about how things ought to work, and I'd support that after some modeling, biologic or theoretical, and then going into patients. No problem with that. But you have to deal with the much narrower therapeutic index. You have to deal with the fact that it may be the old Averbusch Rosen, what we used to do when we were fellows together, giving 5-FU or something every 3 or 4 days, every 3 weeks, might be the best way to give a RAS inhibitor because it might allow you to get intense kill periodically, and that may be the best we can do with this kind of strategy. And then we have the orthogonal immune therapy now, which can be added in some way, perhaps rationally.
I think it's time for... Yes. I have one announcement, though. John Haurum, H-A-U-R-U-M, your wallet is at the front desk.
One rhetorical point before I leave the dais. If there's any company here, representative of a company, who turns their nose up at crizotinib because it's in a small market, I want to hear about it.
All right. Before we adjourn, I just want to note that given all this conversation about the analogies with infectious disease, there was a very interesting, in fact, I showed us one of my slides in Nature Reviews Cancer from May of last year about studying bacterial colonies and resistance and how mathematical modeling of that might be relevant to cancer. So it might be worth everyone's looking. So I want to thank the panelists for a very engaging discussion. I'm sure we could have kept going.
Your Roman honor of comments redeems you for many other comments I didn't like. Okay.
Thank you.
It was really
see you. Thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks.
See you.
See you.
So
if you
have to go.
You want to grab him? All right, we're going to... Whoa. I don't even need a mic with my booming voice. That could be dangerous. All right, we have Dr. George Yancopoulos coming up. And then we'll have our break. So again, thanks to the panelists and thanks to everyone else before for a very lively session. Hopefully that is evidence of what the rest of these panels will be like. So I just would like to introduce George Yancopoulos. Are you ready, George? So I just want to introduce George Yancopoulos, Executive Vice President, CSO, and President of Regeneron Research Laboratories. A great honor to have him, and very much look forward to his talk about angiogenesis. So, thank you, George.
Thank you, Jeff, and appreciate the invitation to speak here and all of your attention. I thought that I would give a talk, since there was a lot of discussion in the panel about what companies do and what large companies do and maybe how small companies might be different. I think it might be worthwhile to see a little bit about our thoughts and perspectives on angiogenesis in cancer, but more broadly, how we sort of attack the field, how do we develop therapeutics, and how there's significant overlap between what we do in the cancer field and in other fields. So I hope people are not bothered by my somewhat overlapping or tangential sort of way I'm going to be dealing with the topic. So you've already heard about from Neil Rosen how anybody would be thankful to have even one approval in a niche setting. That is true, and so I just wanted to start with the slide about how challenging it is in the industry to develop a drug, how few drugs are approved every year, how long it takes, and how rare it is that a single company actually goes all the way from discovery work to the FDA approval in its own lifetime. So it certainly is very challenging, and anybody would be thankful for an approval in any niche setting. So when we started Regeneron more than 20 years ago, we decided that we wanted to build a slightly different company, a company that might be able to buck the odds and build a foundation that could repeatedly go from discovery to the clinic over and over again. And the goal was to provide turnkey solutions for both target validation, that we ended up focusing to a large degree on high-throughput genetics, as well as turnkey solutions for generating therapeutics. And initially, we were widely criticized as we weren't product-driven. We were a research boutique, and we were just worried about technologies. Well, it turns out now I think a lot of people decided that maybe the way we built our business is the way you actually have to do it. You can't just focus on the end game, on the product at the end of the day, but on how you actually build the enterprise and the foundation to create repeatable capabilities and thus create a robust pipelines. And I think, as summarized in the bottom, we're now recognized to have perhaps the most robust pipeline in the industry, consisting of two sets of therapeutic classes of drugs, both of which entirely developed in-house. One, the TRAPS, that I'm going to spend most of my time talking about, and the second being these Velocigene, Velocimmune developed fully human antibody capabilities that we have. So we have three TRAPS that are either already approved or with positive phase three data in five disease indications. The first one, which was approved, was the IL-1 trap, and I will give you some background on it. It may be relevant to cancer. We have some thoughts on it, though our data is not in cancer right now. I'm then going to also talk to you about a VEGF trap, which was recently approved for eye indications, and it's a slightly different version, which has produced positive phase three data in oncology that I'll spend most of my time talking about. And then I'll also build on that to address how we're using our Velocimmune technology to address something that was brought up in the panel about how do you come up with multiple drugs hitting multiple pathway targets so you could give multiple drugs that are all good drugs, not crummy drugs, but good drugs that are hitting different pathways together. And actually, we actually agree in some cases anyway, you want to be giving them continuously and at levels that they're totally blocking their targets to overcome, at least in some settings, and I'm going to get into the setting of angiogenic resistance, overcoming angiogenic resistance. So this just shows a timeline of how over the 20 years we've come to the recent successes that we've had over the last few years, where, as I've said, we've had a number of approvals and a number of positive phase three stories, as well as the establishment and recognition of a very robust pipeline, which is mostly based on this Velocimmune human antibody technology. So, as I said, I'm going to focus mostly on the so-called VEGF trap for oncology, but it's a new therapeutic class, and the first member of this is an interleukin-1 trap, so I thought I would more broadly go back, tell you what a trap is, show you some of the data with the first trap, and then build to the VEGF trap oncology story. So as I said, TRAPs represent a new therapeutic class that were based on very basic receptor signaling insights that we made at Regeneron in the mid-1990s, and it led to development of these things that are known as the TRAPs. So what are the TRAPs? Basically, they built on a very simple notion. The original insights into receptors by people like Yossi Schlesinger and others was that growth factors and cytokines often simply homodimerized receptors to activate them, as is shown on the upper left of the slide. And what you see here is homodimerization of a receptor by a factor. And the first types of soluble decoy receptors, such as Enbrel for TNF, simply built on this homomerization concept and used antibody constant regions to dimerize receptor ectodomains to create homodimers that acted as efficient blockers of certain kinds of growth factors. Well, the simple insight that we had at Regeneron was actually that while a number of receptors worked by the top paradigm, it turns out that many more receptors actually work by what is known as heteromerization paradigm. That is, they brought together two different kinds of receptors. And once we recognized that, we realized that we could make a little simple spin-off of the conventional homodimeric receptor, such as used to make Enbrel, to make heterodimeric receptors, that is, use antibody constant regions to make two different receptors come together and to create high-affinity blockers for those factors and cytokines that didn't generally homodimerize their receptors but used more complex receptor systems. And this approach works rather impressively, and as shown as in the bottom right, we eventually developed this into what is known as a single chain format, where you don't even have to put the subunits on opposite sides. You can actually put them in series and they still work. And so our TRAPs were very useful solutions, and as pointed out on the bottom of the slide, prior to development of our Velocimmune technology, which for us has now replaced our TRAPs, The traps were more efficient and higher affinity than conventional human antibody approaches available at the time to come up with blockers to factors of interest. So generally they made tighter, more potent blockers than antibodies were capable, fully human antibodies were capable of resulting in a number of years ago. So the first trap that we built was against interleukin-1, and the way we came up with our approaches for which traps to build and so forth was, one, what the technology was amenable to, but also where the data was strongest, where we believed the data really suggested that providing a very potent blocker of that growth factor of cytokine might have a disease benefit. And we based our first disease in a very niche indication, but where we were sure that the factor would actually work if it was blocked, based on very strong human genetics that came from people like our collaborators, Hal Hoffman in San Diego and Dan Kastner at the NIH, that suggested that there were certain types of rare diseases that depended on abnormal production of interleukin-1 by this newly discovered inflammasome structure. And this disease varied in its severity from the mildest form, which was still a severe disease, as shown on the left, to very severe and often fatal disease, as indicated on the right side of this continuum. So we did go after the niche approach, that is, let's get a drug that might make a really big difference, at least in this niche setting, prove that the whole approach works, both that the trap approach works and also that this target is a good target and that could actually make a benefit for patients if you applied it to this disease. And that's exactly what we saw in these patients. So this is known as cold-induced autoinflammatory syndrome, or CAPS. Goes by a variety of other names. And this is actually the phase 3 data. Remarkably enough, we were able to do it in about 50 patients per group. And this was because basically there's a key symptom score, a KSS, that you can monitor. As soon as you switch people to drug, as shown on the blue curve in the double-blind portion, their symptoms drop dramatically. As indicated on the numbers on the upper right, there's about an 84% reduction in the key symptom score. So this is exactly, I think, what some of the panelists were talking about. You use biomarkers or genetics to define your population that's really at risk. You go after them, and you provide something that really makes a difference in people's lives. And that's what we did this for, to really try to see if we can make a difference in people's lives. And I have to say we've now met several of these patients. There's only a few hundred of them in the United States. But the drug really makes a difference in their lives. It takes them from really difficult situations beforehand to one where, as described in their own words now, they can really lead a normal and really wonderful life. So the IL-1 trap now goes by the brand name of Arcalis. It's on the market for this niche indication. But once we grew it in this niche situation and validated and proved it, we then, of course, wanted to look for other disease indications where it might also be relevant. And this is exactly what Neil Rosen was talking about. Sometimes you go for a niche indication in Ewing sarcoma, and it turns out that it might work in prostate. Well, it turns out that the same sort of percent benefit that you see in terms of reduction for the key symptom score in this rare orphan disease, you also see in prophylaxis and prevention of gout flares, you see about an 80% reduction in a prophylaxis setting in gout flares. So we think this drug has an opportunity. It's reasonably well tolerated with a very reasonable safety profile in gout. And so we're hoping that we're going to build this product from this niche opportunity in this very rare orphan disease to a more substantial one in gout. So that was an attempt to describe to you what the trap technology is and how our approach is in some way it's akin to what was recommended in the cancer setting as well, about starting with a really well-defined niche setting, really proving that your drug works, and then maybe being able to grow it outside. And we're hoping to do that with our second trap as well, the VEGF trap, and I'm going to get to the oncology story there and how we hope to grow it there as well. But I'm going to first talk about the trap itself. This is a trap addressing VEGF, or vascular endothelial growth factor. We started developing this over 10, 15 years ago now. It was somewhat coincident with Avastin, but fell behind due to resources and the fact that there were no partners who were interested in investing in this at the time. But eventually, we got the resources to move it forward. And we started wondering whether this trap, which at least biochemically in several assays might be a better VEGF blocker than Avastin or bevacizumab, how it might do in the settings in which VEGF blockers have now been validated, both in cancer and in blinding eye diseases. And first, I want to briefly talk about the eye diseases because the VEGF trap has been approved here and really nicely, I think, validated. There's, as you know, a lot of knowledge now about the vascular diseases, the abnormal vascular processes that can lead to a variety of different eye diseases, and most notably now in what is known as age-related macular degeneration, you can beautifully view the living retina. So in the upper right of the slide is a cross-section of a living retina, and that thin section where the thin point where the arrow is pointing is the macula that is the central retina most important for acute vision, and it's the thinnest part of the retina. And unfortunately, and because it's also the most metabolically active part of the retina, this is where disease strikes in age-related macular degeneration. You get abnormal vascular growth and leaking from these abnormal leaking vessels, and you get this swelling, inflammation, and edema that forms due to these abnormal vascular growth, as shown in the scan on the bottom right, which can be dramatically visualized with these living scans. And unfortunately, this can lead to complete blindness in patients. It's the leading cause of blindness in the elderly population in the Western world. The beauty of VEGF inhibitors, as shown here with the VEGF trap, is it can directly address the abnormal vascular growth here. It can dramatically shrink. So on the upper left, this is the same retina I just showed you before treatment. This abnormal swelling, the black spaces are actual fluid and blood buildup in the middle of the macula. With a single injection, within a couple of weeks, the retina starts to normalize. And for many weeks after a single injection, as seen in the series of slides, the retina stays normal, the macula stays thinner, and the vision, as indicated by the number of letters read on an eye chart, goes from 35 letters, which is bordering on legally blind, to 74 letters, which is very close to normal vision. So these drugs really can make a difference. We went head-to-head against the approved agent, ranibizumab or Lucentis, Genentech's approved anti-VEGF agent in the eye, to prove that we were actually clinically equivalent. But the thing that we actually tested in the general AMD population, whether our drug, which is, as I said, at least biochemically more potent and a tighter blocker, could actually last longer. These people with the standard therapy have to be injected monthly to get to retain and to get optimal vision benefit. And we actually showed that we could not only inject monthly, but we could inject twice the interval and get the same visual benefit, presumably because we had a better VEGF blocker. And this led to the VEGF trap eye version being approved by the FDA. Its brand name is now Eylea, and its generic name is intravitreal aflibercept 4 injection. And there's a lot of important considerations that if anybody's interested in using it should really focus on and understand and read. So the launch is underway. It's actually been a very impressive launch. It's really bucked the industry trends. It's exceeded all expectations. And the usage of this in the first quarter was something on the order of 5 to 10 times higher than most of the financial analysts predicted. And I think it's because this drug really works and really works well. And one thing that we've been getting back, feedback, from physicians who've been using this drug and their patients is that though the drug wasn't necessarily tested this way, which is perhaps why it wasn't shown to have this particular benefit, they have often started in their practices to use it by taking patients who were poor responders to the standard therapy and switching them. And many practices are now reporting it at at meetings, their experience is in case studies showing that when they switch patients, patients can actually have an impressive response to Eylea where they hadn't been responding to a previous therapy. So this is just one case study example from Dr. Jason Slachter here in New York, who had a patient who had been treated with the standard therapy monthly for over 3 years, and as you can see on the upper right, still huge accumulations of fluid in the retina. After a single injection of the Eylea or the intravitreal aflibercept, the retina seemed to remarkably normalize and the patient gained vision. So this just shows the hope and the value that if you produce a better blocker for something that's out there, you might actually end up getting better outcomes, at least in some patients used in the right situation. And so Eylea is a very important opportunity. Obviously, it's really already looks like it's making a benefit to patients suffering from wet AMD, but it's also growing into a number of other indications. We recently reported very positive and very impressive phase 3 data in a different blinding eye disease known as central retinal vein occlusion, and the drug is also in phase 3 studies for diabetic eye disease and so forth. So we're very excited about this, and we think that the VEGF trap now has proven that it can really make a difference in patients' lives in the eye. So the question is, what about in cancer? Certainly, once again, the fact that it looked like it might be a better VEGF blocker suggests that it might also afford further benefit to patients in cancer settings. So in animal models, it certainly behaved very impressively. On the right, just showing a cross-section of a treated tumor, showing that if you treat pre-growth, it can completely block blood vessel formation. This slide shows just so how dramatically it works in monotherapy. On the upper left-hand is the tumor before treatment, and within hours, what you can see is that you can immediately get hypoxia, indicated in red, occur really dramatically within the tumor, and it's also graphically represented on the red line, the dramatic induction of hypoxia and the dramatic loss of blood vessels within hours. The little green lines are the blood vessels, and you can see either in the sections from 16 to 72 hours or in the graphic summary how as the vessels drop out, the hypoxia increases. So the animal data really suggested that this was a powerful agent. We were hoping that it could really prove itself in the clinic as well. And we recently did announce, in collaboration with our partner Sanofi, that the VEGF trap oncology version of this drug, which is now known by the brand name of Zaltrap and the generic name of aflibercept, was able to produce an improvement in overall survival, meeting the primary endpoint of the study, and the full results were first presented at the ESMO conference last June. And I just wanted to highlight some of the results. So there was an overall survival effect of about a month and a half. The safety profile was quite analogous to that which has been seen with bevacizumab. And as what you can see here is that in pretty much all pre-specified subgroups, one sees a favoring of the Zaltrap or of the aflibercept over the control regimen in this study. But most importantly, 30% of the patients were pre-specified in this study or stratified to be separately analyzed and prospectively analyzed because they were prior Avastin failures. So it seems as if the benefit was also manifest in these people, and it was quite evident in the PFS seen in these people who had been prior bevacizumab failures, where you saw a PFS in this population of 3.9 months, which is extended to 6.7 months upon retreatment with the VEGF trap or aflibercept. So, as I said, the study was certainly positive in all of its endpoints, and we hope that that the FDA will look at it this way and add this to the armamentarium of agents that are available for patients suffering from this particular disease. But I want to focus on a couple of points here. One addresses the point that, of course, just like a lot of other cancer advances, the benefit is incremental. As was mentioned by Neil Rosen, these drugs are giving, you know, a month or two or three in these settings, it would be nice to see more. And certainly we would want to figure out how to see more from the VEGF trap in this setting as well. But another important thing that might actually speak to that and how maybe we've been misusing these drugs is that we had the pre-planned subgroup analyses which showed that across all of these the drug was active, but including prior treatment and progression on bevacizumab. So what does that mean? Does that mean because our drug is actually more potent and it can actually work in people who failed bevacizumab? Well, that is a little bit of a possibility. But I think I'm going to get to another possibility, which has to do with something that was brought up before, which has to do with intermittent therapy or continuous therapy or what I'm going to refer to as treatment through progression. Before I go on to that, I also wanted to comment on the fact that, as you well know, now the VEGF trap becomes only the second anti-VEGF agent that really shows important benefits in colorectal cancer. This contrasts with the so-called VEGF kinase inhibitors. I don't want to dwell on this extensively, except to perhaps make the comment that I think a lot of us are now realizing that the so-called VEGF kinase inhibitors are fundamentally different drugs. Yes, they overlap. They have some blockade of VEGF, but they actually have a broader spectrum of blockade that gives them their biological activity. So what's clear is in this setting, if you have something that is a specific and rather complete blocker of VEGF, you can have a benefit, whereas if you have these broader acting agents, but ones that do not do as good a job in blocking the VEGF pathway in particular, such as the kinase inhibitors, perhaps that's why they don't seem to manifest their activity in the setting like the two biologics that now have demonstrated their activity. So yes, this just shows that we are going to be filing to add to our list of recent filings the Zaltrap data. Our partners have already filed on it, and we hope to be hearing from the FDA in the not-too-distant future. But getting back to this point about how to improve on the incremental benefit of anti-VEGF therapies, and the first point has to do with why it was that the drug seemed to work in so-called bevacizumab failures. And as I said, it's possible that it's because it's more potent. But another very likely possibility really has to do with the fact of how anti-VEGFs have been used to this point and maybe how they've been misused and how perhaps the community can get better benefit from these agents. So the way they've been used, and this is really just based on historical artifact, is that once one gets what is called tumor progression, that is, for example, a 20% increase in growth from the nadir, one switches the therapy. And because that's been done historically with a lot of chemotherapeutic agents, that's how bevacizumab to date has generally been used as well. Just to show you, this is a typical animal model. The blue, so the red line is an untreated animal tumor. The blue line is a treated animal tumor. Where that arrow is indicating is where the tumor in the animal setting has actually achieved a 60% tumor growth. Okay, so that's 60% progression. So, of course, normally in the clinic, one would stop treating at that point. Well, in the animals, if you stop treating at that point, you get the green curve. That is, of course, the drug is still active, though the tumor is growing slowly. Though the tumor has progressed, there's still a very profound effect of the anti-VEGF agent, in this case the VEGF trap, on the tumor. The last thing you'd want to do is release the tumor from VEGF inhibition. When you release it, you get the green curve. If you keep it on, the tumor continues to progress, but much, much, much more slowly. And I think that this is the most likely explanation for the data, that is why in our second-line colorectal cancer we had these rather impressive effects on prior bevacizumab failures or on patients who had progressed on bevacizumab. I think it's simply reflecting the same thing and supports the notion that treatment through progression with anti-VEGF agents really could substantially improve the ultimate benefit to the patient and actually provide a much bigger benefit in terms of long-term survival than has been seen to date. So certainly we've been pushing this premise or paradigm for a while, and it looks like Roche Genentech shares a similar perspective. For example, just some comments that were made at last year's ASCO is that a key message for them now is to emphasize longer periods of utilization through multiple lines of therapy and as maintenance to maximize the clinical benefit. And they certainly have a lot of data themselves that supports this notion. This is what's been referred to often as a failed study, an adjuvant study in colorectal cancer. What people, I think, need to recognize is during the first year when patients were on treatment, it was actually a rather impressive hazard ratio of 0.6, which was lost as soon as people, which was lost gradually over the next couple of years as people actually went off treatment. So, once again, supporting that for these agents, the only way you're going to maintain benefit is to maintain consistent, constant blockade. They all, also, the GOG had a very nice result that really supported this, the same notion. The blue curve is patients who were only on up until the first vertical line, and the yellow patients are the patients who were on through the second yellow line. You can see the benefit is there, and it starts dissipating as soon as you stop treatment. And that seems to be the case for anti-VEGFs in general. So that's, I think, one really important point that I think we're beginning to recognize, and I hope the field is really beginning to recognize generally, that to get the maximum benefit for these drugs and provide the maximum survival advantage for the patients, the paradigm has to switch. There has to be treatment through progression. And really, a much more complex understanding of combination activity with chemotherapeutic agents, which I don't have time to really get into. But what I was going to end with was another way that we hope that we can improve on the incremental benefit provided by anti-VEGF biologics. And that has to do with novel combinations, and certainly novel combinations with non-angiogenics. That's what I don't have time to get into. But I also think the notion that just attacking the angiogenic pathway at one point is also naive. That angiogenesis, just like everything else, has multiple pathways which are required for it to operate and multiple pathways for resistance. And just like we heard before, to get at resistance or to really knock out this pathway, you need to hit it in a couple different places, in a couple different places, hard and simultaneously. And Neil Rosen likes experiments. We do too. And so this is a hypothesis that I just stated. It seemed pretty obvious, but of course we wanted to test it. And so what we set out to do was to model what we thought was the human situation, where, of course, people continue to either grow slowly on anti-VEGF therapy, as I've already shown you, where we advocate continuous treatment with anti-VEGF therapy, or in some cases they switch to a much faster growth paradigm. And it turns out that tumor models in mice, you can get them to model almost anything you want, and you can look very much just like any one of the human settings that we often see in the clinic. That is, you can have patients or you can have animal models like the green line where with continuous VEGF trap treatment, the tumor grows very, very slowly and doesn't seem to escape. You can also have all the intermediate settings, including very resistant tumors that even on continuous anti-VEGF therapy immediately start almost breaking out and growing, or it takes them some time to grow out. So we've started studying very carefully what these various tumors are doing, and what we've identified is that almost anything you can think of happens. There's many, many mechanisms to resistance to anti-VEGF therapy, and I think this gets back at the niche notion that was raised during the panel. That is that there's not probably going to be one size-fits-all cure for everybody here, that it might very well be worthwhile to be sampling the tumors as we do in the animal settings and figure out which therapy it better caters to which patient or to which tumor. So some tumors develop what we call angiogenic resistance. That is, there are new angiogenic pathways that they invoke or rely on. There's others that have sort of so-called tumor cell resistance, that the tumor cell doesn't require as much angiogenesis, and the tumor is now resistant to VEGF or any angiogenic blockade. So you get all sorts of different types of resistance, and I just want to show you the angiogenic pathways that we found that most commonly can contribute to so-called angiogenic resistance as opposed to the other types of resistance. And there's two pathways in particular that we focus on that seem to be the most important, the so-called angiopoietin 2 pathway and the delta-like ligand 4 pathway, Ang2 or DLL4. And before I get into some of the animal data with these and how they do seem to provide combination opportunities with anti-VEGF therapies, I want to just slightly distract you to make the point that when you're in this sort of field and you're trying to discover new targets, you need new technologies to address potential new targets, both to discover and to validate them, but also to come up with therapeutics against them. And the technologies that we've developed over the last 10 years or so to do this that have been incredibly powerful for us and have really been game-changing are what we call VelociGene and VelociMmune. So before I tell you a little bit more about Ang2 and DLL4 and how it seems that at least in some settings of angiogenic resistance to anti-VEGF therapy, they might be important combination opportunities, I want to talk to you a little bit about these technologies and how we rapidly use them. So as I said early on at Regeneron, we didn't just want to focus on one product opportunity. We wanted to build a foundation that would allow us to do things over and over and over again. And what we realized that in order to do this, we really needed to be the premier leaders in the industry in controlling the genome, and particularly the controlling the genome of the most important laboratory animal, the mouse. And for many reasons, including for the reasons of creating genetically humanized models. And towards this end, we developed these technologies that now go by the names of Veloci technology. VelociGene is really the new standard for mouse genetics. It's much more powerful and much more high throughput than any other technologies available to date. They can create almost any mutation, any size, that is from a point mutation to megabase size humanizations that allow us to validate drug targets in mice and create almost any genetically humanized animal model that we want. And in fact, the premier genetically humanized animal model that we created was what we call VelociMmune, which could only be created by virtue of VelociGene. It's actually a mouse with a humanized immune system that's been humanized in a way that wasn't even imaginable up until we had the VelociGene technology. So it's a novel way of genetically humanizing the immune system, which now I think has is become increasingly accepted as the new standard for making fully human antibodies to validated drug targets. So I don't have time to tell you the details of VelociGene. The first generation of it was published a few years ago. You can look it up. But I just want to make the point that it uses very large bacterial artificial chromosome of hundreds of kilobases at a time to manipulate the genome and allows everything, as I said, from point mutation to mega humanizations. And that's how we actually use this technology to make this VelociMmune, which involved 6 megabases of humanization. 6 megabases of mouse immune loci were precisely humanized. And I said, not only is this the new standard, it's probably the most valuable mouse, if not biotechnology, ever created. It's already generated over $2 billion in already committed licensing and collaboration revenues. But most importantly for us, in addition to the resources that these technologies bring, they bring therapeutic candidates. They validate and bring to us therapeutic candidates. And so we use these technologies to first validate angiopoietin 2 and DLL4, but also, as shown on the bottom, to create very high-affinity, fully human blocking antibodies that very rapidly went into the clinic, and they're already in clinical trials. And though I don't have the clinical trial results to report to you yet, I just wanted to show you at least for one of these, the angiopoietin 2, how interesting and exciting I think the combination data are in animal studies. So when you combine these two anti-angiogenics, what you see in the red, this is looking at tumor perfusion, and we can image this in a variety of different ways, but tumor perfusion is obviously affected with VEGF inhibition. That's the red column. It's also inhibited to a somewhat more minor degree with just Ang2 inhibition, but when you combine them, you get much more profound inhibition of tumor perfusion. And this is almost immediate effects in terms of tumor perfusion. As you might expect, related to that, is you also see combination effects on tumor kill, and this is manifested whether you're doing, in this particular case, so-called tunnel staining of the tumors, or if you're just looking at whole tumor growth. And as you can see on the bottom right, you're now going to a situation where you can cause profound tumor regression. That is not only hold tumors in check, but actually cause them to regress, and in a setting where the animal is actually tolerating this continuous high-dose combination anti-angiogenic blockade quite well. So this slide just summarizes that the Ang2 and the DLL4 are two of our recent entry into the clinics. Those two antibodies are in phase one studies, but the fully human antibodies that we've gotten from Velocimmune have really been moving quite impressively into and through the clinic, with several of them in phase three. And the ones that are in phase three, though they're not in cancer settings, have been progressing and producing highly impressive data in phase two. And I just want to make that comment that certainly these antibodies, not the Ang2 and the DLL4 so far, but their predecessors that came from this technology, the ones that are now in phase three, really were quite impressive in terms of their ability to attack their target and to produce the desired clinical effects in phase two studies. So the most two advanced antibodies that we have coming from the Velocimmune pipeline, one is in, represents a new class of cholesterol-lowering drugs, and the other is an improved version of an IL-6 blocker. And there's a large unmet need for new cholesterol-lowering agents. Once again, we focused on a genetics to give us a new target that came from our collaborator, Helen Hobbs, at University of Texas Southwestern. And in phase one and phase two studies, the effects of this antibody are actually quite stunning, with 60% reductions in cholesterol in patients who are maximum doses of statins and still not at goal. And similarly, the IL-6 antibody is producing very impressive data in phase two as well. So I come to the end now, and I just want to try to put it back into perspective of where we are today and how we got here and what we're excited about. We have our TRAP pipeline, which has culminated with our recent data with VEGF-TRAP-I and VEGF-TRAP-Oncology. We think in terms of VEGF-TRAP-Oncology, the data from our positive phase three study in second-line colorectal is very exciting and important, however, represents yet again another incremental advance in the field. What we're hoping to do now is to couple it with our new sets of pipeline candidates coming from our Velocimmune technologies, our fully human antibodies coming from Velocimmune, that can be now combined perhaps with the VEGF trap to provide two good blockers in at least of two anti-angiogenics, but we're also developing some antibodies that are attacking other aspects of tumor biology that we think might be combined in interesting ways with anti-VEGFs to add to the incremental benefit and ultimately provide a better outcome for patients. So I guess that's our perspective on angiogenesis and cancer and other settings. And if we have time, I'd be glad to answer any questions. And thanks for your attention.
Hi, it's Larry back here. To carry together the theme of the first session, it's over here. Look, turn to your left. Hi, over here. Hi. The growth curve data that you show, I've seen that before with another drug. The other drug is cyclophosphamide. If you go back in the early days in the animal systems and even clinical in breast cancer, we used to give daily oral cyclophosphamide for 18 months in the adjuvant setting. It's growth suppressant because of the dose. And you stop it, and obviously tumor grows. The curves look exactly the same. And it was only when we went to higher dose intermittent therapy that we actually started getting significant tumor regression and getting cures. And when you have two agents, that opens up the possibility of alternating them, for example, knowing if you use the right engineering and you have the right sequence, or using one continuously with pulses of another. So is that kind of work going on in your company to try to come up with novel schedules that might be able to optimize the effect? Because just growth suppression, obviously it's a movement in the right direction, but what we want to see is tumor eradication.
Right. Well, as I said, in certain tumors... Is this working? In certain tumors, when you combine the agents, you can actually get profound tumor regression. In other settings, we agree with you that, especially because it sort of relates to cyclophosphamide. I mean, one of the issues with it is if you give high doses, tolerability is a very serious issue. So in terms of these anti-angiogenics, you have sort of the same things. Anti-VEGF is reasonably well tolerated, but there are serious issues with continuous, you know, a high level blockade of VEGF. Whereas it seems as if some of the other anti-angiogenics might be, better tolerated. So certainly in animals, we have models where you can give them together, get complete blockade, and then have one of them, the one that's better tolerated, sort of on board to allow for continuous suppression, but then, you know, sort of retreat with high-level blockade of the combination at a later point. But it is relates to what Neil Rosen said, is that we have animal models that sort of reflect probably every one of the different human situations that you can get. So you can get something that will work in this model but not in that model. And it seems to me that the same is probably true in the human setting, and one's going to have to probably tailor, based on a variety of approaches, which regimen, which recipe, which schedule, you know, might be best for certain patients. And that's going to certainly be challenging.
Well, that's where functional imaging could come in the individual location at a real degree. But I think a more pulsatile, higher-dose approach, especially with two agents, you know, alternating, you might get even better results than the chronic suppression.
I would agree.
Hi. My name is Wenxi. Thank you for your talk. I've been following your work for a number of years. In fact, my PhD was in angiogenesis, specifically the role of delta-like 4. My question is that nowadays in the field, there are comments like angiogenesis is like the hot therapy of yesteryear, right? So now the pipelines are loaded, and in the next decade, the hot thing is going to be immunotherapy, for example, right? So what is your projection for the role of anti-angiogenesis therapy going forward? Thank you.
Well, after being in this industry for a long time, what I've recognized is that what's hot today is usually forgotten tomorrow, and then sometimes becomes hot 20 years from now. I think that there is enormous potential, certainly in immunotherapy, but there's also enormous potential in anti-angiogenic therapy. I think that we are only now, as reflected by Larry's questions, but a lot of my data, we are only now realizing how naive we've been about how to use these drugs to maximize their therapies. And nobody could possibly think, you know, Neil Rosen, you know, kept making the point where he doesn't think he's the smartest, you know, guy in the room. Well, I guarantee you he is one of the smartest guys in the room, yet neither he nor I nor all of us could really anticipate the best ways to use these things. I think that there's going to be so much room for experimentation, as I've already shown you, to amplify the benefit to the patients. And these agents are already in, you know, they've been shown in patients to actually have a benefit. And I think a challenge that we should all try to meet is how to improve and maximize on this, because these agents work. They've just been, I think, because it takes so long for us to get sophisticated about it, they've been largely misused to date. And they've still been able to show benefit, you know, statistically significant incremental benefit. I think if we get a little smarter about how to use them and how to combine them and so forth, we could end up making bigger differences in patients' lives, which is what it's all about. And it's certainly near-term opportunities.
George.
George, great presentation. John Reed, Sanford Burnham. In terms of combinations of new anti-angiogenic therapies, have you looked into combining anti-angiogenic therapies with something like an autophagy inhibitor? You might expect that tumor cells would become much more dependent on autophagy for their survival in the context of angiogenesis inhibition. Are you looking at that? There are a lot of attractive druggable targets in the autophagy world.
So when we're talking about what, I mean, I think that is actually a great point, which we're not focusing on autophagy, but what we've recognized, and this is also something that you only recognize when you're in the field for a while, but I think this is a really important point. When you create an anti-angiogenic effect and you're creating profound decrease in tumor perfusion and profound increases in tumor hypoxia, you are changing the biology of that tumor very, very dramatically, which creates all sorts of new targets that are now specific to that treated tumor. And that treated tumor, I can tell you, is much more hypoxic, for example, than normal tissues in the body. So I think that those sorts of things, that those afford a whole new set of targets that really haven't even been thought about before. So we've actually seen that there are certain things that are induced by tumor hypoxia, which are not seen in normal tissues normally, normal tissues in the setting of anti-VEGFs because they don't really suffer as much from anti-VEGF therapies, but are very specific now to a challenged tumor in that setting. And I think that these are new targets, new metabolisms that the tumor turns on in the settings are new targets that one could target with either small drugs or in our cases with antibodies to get profound additional combination effects. So I think that this field really is in its infancy. I think that we have agents that have activities here, and I think the real challenge is going to be over the course. It's going to take years, is going to figure out how to maximize. But I think that that point is a really good one. The tumors turn on new metabolisms to deal with their new challenge, and those are new targets that we can all think about addressing.
George.
One more question.
Can you speak a little bit, please, about the biology of DLL4 and Ang2? And in particular, did you show a slide that hypoxia is induced almost immediately after administration of a combination in mice? And if so, that doesn't jibe with kind of my view of what an anti-angiogenic does. Why would the effect be immediate rather than delayed at the level of new blood vessel growth or whatever?
Yeah, I did actually show a couple slides on that. The effect is actually immediate, and the reason that we know that is the case is that in the setting of normal tissues, the normal tissue blood vascular is quite stable, and it's no longer dependent on either VEGF or angiopoietin 2 for its continued existence and survival. However, a large proportion, not all, but a large proportion of tumor vessels are still relatively immature. They've never stabilized. And they are dependent on either VEGF or on Ang2 for their survival. So when you treat with anti-VEGF, you actually lose very rapidly a significant proportion of your tumor vessels. And you cause almost immediately, within hours as I showed, profound decreases in tumor perfusion and the resulting tumor hypoxia. It's the same with anti-Ang2, but it seems as if there's different vessels that are dependent on VEGF for their existence and on Ang2 for their existence, so when you hit them with both, you lose even more vessels and you get more profound decreases in perfusion and bigger increases in hypoxia.
So the vessels are actually, it's not spasm of the vessel, it's actually destruction
it's actually loss
of the vessel.
It's actually loss of the vessels.
Thank you very much. We're going to take a five-minute break because we ate up 10 minutes of our break. So grab something outside and come back.